Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. As part of Breaking Barriers, Women in Oncology, Cancer Network's Arianna Pelosi spoke with Dr. Maha Hussain and Dr. Sarah Fenton from Northwestern Medicine about advances in GU oncology, as well as their personal experiences in the field. Hussain and Fenton focused on how research in the field has grown, highlighting improvements in survival for patients with different types of prostate cancer. Other topics they discussed included the challenge of maintaining a healthy work-life balance, especially when it comes to raising their families while advancing their careers.
So just to kick this off, Dr. Hussain, maybe you want to start discussing a little bit what interests you in focusing in genitourinary oncology specifically, and then Dr. Fenn, you can chime in too.
Sure. So I started my training at Wayne State as an intern, resident, and then fellow. And part of my rotations were actually in one of the oldest VAs in the country. In fact, one of the first VAs in the country that was established before World War II. And it's called the Ellen Park VA. And what was shocking to me at the time is that literally between even the Central Hospital, which is Harbor Hospital, and the VA, or there was an emergency hospital, Detroit receiving, so many times I get, as an intern or resident or a fellow, get to see patients presenting with cord compression. And then you find out that they actually had prostate cancer after the fact. And same happened with the VA hospital. And it was really very shocking. And so at the time, I was being groomed to be a breast oncologist, clinical researcher, translational researcher, but I really felt much more compelled by the lack of care and information, treatments, life prolonging stuff for patients with prostate cancer and bladder cancer and kidney cancer. So that really got me attracted to kind of focus on, you know, helping to see if we can do better for these patients.
And then Dr. Fenn, what made you interested in genitourinary oncology?
Sure. I think it's interesting to hear Dr. Hussain's story because I came into the field at such a different time, right? Where we have made so much progress based on the work of people like Dr. Hussain. And so I was a fellow, knew I wanted to stay in academic medicine and was kind of looking at the landscape. And the thing that's really special, I think, about treating genitourinary cancers is that you have a wide breadth of treatment modalities that you implement. Like you treat prostate cancer, you really focus on hormone-targeted therapies there. You treat bladder, where we do a lot of chemotherapy and androgen, antibody drug conjugates. You do testicular, where, again, chemotherapy is a big player. And then you use completely different treatments for renal, a lot of immunotherapy, a lot of tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So I found that like breadth of treatment options to be really interesting, really intellectually stimulating. And then the patients too. Like there's something special to me about the patient population we get to treat and we get to interact with. And then the third part is there's such a wide range of acuity too. Right? You have patients who do well for years and years. You get to develop that type of relationship. You also have very sick people where you can see the impact you have on their lives immediately. So it just was a nice fit for me because of the diversity that you see while still being able to really deep dive and like really specialize in specific disease types.
Thank you. Both have great reasons for kind of focusing in GU oncology space. Moving on, what would be any key research advances that you've been involved in that you're most proud of? Dr. Fenton, if you want to start first.
Sure. I'm glad I'm starting because Dr. Hussain will have so much more to say.
And by the way, ladies, you can call me Maha. You don't have to call me Dr. Hussain.
I'm new. My career has just started, right? I'm about a year and a half into practice. So most of the research that I've had the opportunity and I'm most proud of been able to really dive deeply into happened during my fellowship. And there I was really interested in some projects focused on immunotherapy resistance I think the most natural correlation in the GU space is within bladder, but we really identified this mechanism that drives resistance to immunotherapy that can be theoretically targeted. We showed benefit in melanoma and are expanding it into other models. And I think that's the project that I really spent the most time with at this point and I'm most proud of. But we have several other projects that we're working on. Maha and I have been working on some novel combination therapies in prostate cancer. We've been looking at some risk factors that increase or increase risk, I should say, for young patients with prostate cancer. It's kind of a diverse group of projects that I've been really lucky to take part in.
And then, Dr. Hussein, did you want to highlight any specific key research advances you've been a part of throughout your career?
I have been quite fortunate in that I have either been part of or led efforts that end up leading to what I would call transformational type of outcomes and standards of care. So I will begin first by highlighting the fact that I was still junior relatively, but was actually appointed as the Advanced Prostate Cancer Committee Chair for the SWOG. And at the time, Dr. Dan Petrylak, who is a very well-known investigator now, we're both sort of like the new kids on the block, and he came to share with me information on a phase one trial that they had done, early phase trial with docetaxel. And when I look at the data, then, by the way, we only had mitoxantrone, and that was the only FDA-approved chemo, and it wasn't based on really any survival advantage. And just looking at the response and the data, I felt like let's jump into phase three trial. And to my delight, in 2004, I believe it was a plenary session presentation at ASCO, and it was the trial that Dan Petrylak led, which was the SWOG-led intergroup trial, and actually the key Taxotere trial, which led to both, the FDA approval of docetaxel at the time. I was also involved in the design of the CHAARTED trial, which moved docetaxel into the metastatic hormone-sensitive space. And we had meetings at the NCI and discussions amongst the groups. And it was an intergroup trial, again, led by not a SWOG leader, but the end result was the first trial to demonstrate an overall survival difference in the metastatic hormone-sensitive space. I also was the PI for an international study, that's SWOG 9346, which actually compared intermittent to continuous therapy. And this was based on emerging data that allowing the cancer to still be responsive to androgens, to testosterone, may allow you to do a better job at controlling it so that it doesn't become resistant. And so that was an international trial that I had the privilege of leading, was US, Canada, and Europe intergroup trial. Now, unfortunately, that trial did not show that actually intermittent therapy resulted in better outcomes, but there were several information emerging from it that I reported, including the role of nadir PSA as a predictive biomarker for or a prognostic and predictive potentially for outcomes. Then I was fortunate enough when I was at University of Michigan to be part of the Stand Up to Cancer team. And as you know, the Stand Up to Cancer team was a large team, both US and the Marsden from the UK, with Johann de Bono participating, led by Dr. Arul Chinayan. And the work there actually is defined the genomic profile of prostate cancer, which then led to different things and ultimately guided us to design the PROfound trial, which I was one of the two PIs for internationally with Dr. Johann de Bono. And that was the first clinical trial that actually brings precision medicine into the field of prostate cancer. And then in the meantime, before the PSMA imaging and so on, we knew that men who were on hormone treatment for, say, PSA relapse or as adjuvant, some of them can actually progress to castration resistance. And as it turns out, there was a whole space, this is pre-PSMA imaging era, where there was a group of men that we would call non-metastatic castration-resistant disease. And when I say non-metastatic, as in not visibly metastatic, we know that their PSA is rising, their testosterone is suppressed, and their imaging is negative. So I actually was one of the two PIs with Dr. Cora Sternberg leading the trial with enzalutamide in the context of non-metastatic castration-resistant disease, which led to an FDA approval. And I think there are several other things I'm involved in, but I would say these would be the key highlights there. And recently reported data from the Breakaway study, which I'm happy to chat about later on. But it clearly, while it's a small study, it shows that the value of combination therapy, PARP inhibitor and AR inhibitor, as opposed to sequential treatment in preselected patient population.
Great. I think those were both really, really good overviews of both of your careers. So kind of branching off that last question, Dr. Hussein, how have you seen the GU space evolve from a research standpoint since the start of your career until now?
I think it has evolved dramatically. And in the older days, really nobody wanted to work on prostate cancer or bladder cancer or kidney cancer. And so our major source of treatments and funding was from the NCI. And the cooperative groups actually did a great job in terms of leading efforts to evaluate, different agents, strategies, like the intermittent trial. This was like a 1,000-patient trial. So the reality of it is this: these are efforts at the time, and then I'm delighted to say now that the whole field has changed significantly. And aside from the usual federal and international nonprofit entities, we now actually have pharmaceutical companies partnering with us on the different trials that we're working on and different strategies and so on. So I do think the field has moved quite a bit, and I always mention this, Arianna. When I entered the field, the patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, median survival was 9 months. And patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, actually, their median survival was about 2.5 years, just under 3 years. And now we've moved into a totally different space where it's almost tripled, I want to say, in terms of the out survivals. And many men are living much longer. And I'm hoping that at some point, many of them will hopefully be cured with better treatment strategies and better imaging and so on.
So, Dr. Fenn, as you mentioned, you're just starting out in your career. How would you like to see the field evolve over, let's say, the next 5 years or so?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think kind of going off of what Maha was saying, a lot of the progress that we've made has come through therapy intensification, earlier therapy initiation, using more modalities that use different mechanisms at the same time to control the disease more aggressively at the outset. And really here, I'm thinking most of prostate, but we've seen really great progress in bladder and renal as well, not even to mention testicular. So all of these outcomes are improving. And now the space that I would love to see patients moving into is we get great control and then they're able to come off of treatment, either permanently because we've really started to cure these patients, these men and women with these diagnoses, or, get good control and then allow a treatment-free interval. Although, as Dr. Hussein, the intermittent therapy has previously been a little bit dicey. But still, I mean, that is where I hope we're headed. We're seeing these great improvements in outcomes. I obviously want to see that continue and continue to improve. But it would be great if we can increase our ability to cure these patients, as we've seen in testicular.
So, Dr. Hussein, I know you were discussing a trial that you're currently involved in. Would you like to highlight that more?
The one that I was mentioning is the Breakaway trial, which is a clinical trial that I designed somewhere around 2016, and actually long before any of the data from any of the phase III trials. Some of them were not designed yet, and some of them were not even reported yet. And so The Breakaway trial was trying to answer the question again in the Stand Up to Cancer data. What was very clear that there was a panel of genomic alterations that are, the homologous recombination repair pathway, and definitely was present in men with metastatic castration-resistant disease. And one of the issues, there was emerging data also from Dr. Karen Knudsen's team and others. I want to say in the sort of the before around 2010, perhaps, or before 2010, regarding the potential synergistic interaction between the PARP inhibitor and the androgen receptor signaling pathways. And so there was preclinical data that was emerging. So I actually did my first combination trial, designed it somewhere, again, over maybe about 14, over 14 years ago. It was part of the Stand Up to Cancer trial research effort, and it was a combination with veliparib and abiraterone. And unfortunately, that did not deliver. This was an all-comer. And then, of course, we moved on, and we got into the field of single agent, with Profound and other agents getting approved by the FDA in men with previously pretreated prostate cancer for castration-resistant disease, and they have the HRR mutations. But one of the questions was, when we develop combination treatments, is it a must? And if a patient is going to be responsive to one drug, do you have to give them two drugs together, or do you do it sequentially? And the whole goal would be to save patients from the physical and monetary cost. And if it's not necessary and they are in response for many years, why kind of dump everything all at one time? Because again, potential risks for them. And so the trial was designed to look at patients who were preselected for BRCA1, 2, and ATM alterations. And this was based on real-time fresh tissue. And then afterwards, we allowed ctDNA. And this could have been germline or somatic. And basically, men were randomized to either abiraterone with prednisone or olaparib or the combination. And the trial, again, unlike the phase threes, did not allow, the trial actually allowed crossover. And so the patients in the Abi arm could cross over to olaparib and vice versa. And it was interesting, despite crossover, basically, the doublet, the combination treatment resulted in a much better progression-free survival. And to me, it's shocking because it's actually right now what we have, the median is almost over 3 years, which is remarkable for the setting of patients with castration-resistant disease. So I think that's exciting. Obviously, the caveat, this is not a large study, it's 20 patients per arm and so on, but the separation of the curves were really pretty impressive. So I think the answer right now is if a patient frontline has the HRR mutation, that's based on the FDA approval, it's different panels for each of the combinations. For sure, I would go with the doublet treatment.
Great. And then Dr. Fenton, is there anything that you'd like to highlight, any research you're involved in?
I think the real thing that I've been spending a lot of time on, and one of the biggest benefits of having a great relationship with Maha, is we need to spend a lot of time thinking about trial design. Like, she and I just opened a trial at Northwestern, looking back at the new triplet data that's come out and really trying to answer some of the questions that have come out of that more carefully and in a more stringent design. I think that also speaks to what Maha was just saying about the Brackaway trial. Like, why has this been such an influential trial when we've seen so many reports about PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer? And I think it's because it's a great trial design, right? You really compare directly three different treatments or three different sequences of treatments, I should say, maybe. And you really can apply that directly to your patients in clinic. So to me, as an early investigator, when I have such a wealth of topics that I can investigate, the really important thing is making sure you're thinking carefully about what's worth investing in, first of all, because all of us only have so much time. And second of all, like, making sure if you're investing that time, you're really being careful about how you design that trial, what is the question you're answering, and are you confident that you're going to be able to answer that question? And so I think, to me, that's something that I like spending a lot of time thinking about, and I think I've really benefited from with the mentorship relationships I've had.
Great. So switching over now to some of the non-clinical questions. As we know, GU is predominantly a male field. So did either of you have any difficulty breaking into the field? And maybe as you were starting to get integrated more into GU oncology, did you have any surprises of the differences between how men and women were treated as practicing oncologists?
So I am going to shock you and tell you that no, there's no issues. I trained, as I said, at Wayne State, and as an intern and resident, and then fellow, worked with certainly several of the what I would call the hip ladies of the time that were leaders, that were emerging leaders in their field. Some of them were not very senior, some were senior. But beginning with Dr. Julie Kish, who was a head and neck medical oncologist, Dr. Tony Wozniak, who is a lung medical oncologist, and Dr. Silvana Martino, who is a breast medical oncologist. And from the days when I was a resident and then subsequently as a fellow, we connected quite a bit. And literally till today, we are friends. But I want to flip back and highlight the fact that, again, from the older days, I must admit that I have so many male mentors that have supported my path, advised me, and helped me with my career. And this is beginning with our days in residency, but subsequently in fellowship. And so I did my fellowship at Wayne State. At the time, Larry Baker was the division chief, and he was a phenomenal, phenomenal supporter. Dr. John Inslee, physician scientist, head and neck, phenomenal supporter, and worked with him on project. Dr. Rick Pazdur, who is the head of the FDA oncology branch, was actually my fellowship director. And he was, again, aside from that, he was an incredible mentor. And then moving even further in terms of not so much necessarily mentorship, but in terms of career support, I have to give credit to Dr. David Crawford, who was the chair of the GU Committee of SWOG. And he is the one that asked me to take the lead on the Advanced Prostate Cancer Subcommittee, which I believe I'm the first woman to have done that at the time. And then there weren't that many, again, there weren't that many GU medical oncologists doing a lot of research in GU field, but that was that. And then Mario Eisenberger, who was the also co-chair of the committee. Moving further, I would say I got recruited by Doctors Mark Lipman and Ellen Lichter to University of Michigan. They, literally reached out to me and invited me to, to join the faculty there. And collaborating from the days of Wayne State with urology team and Dr. Jim Monti, who was the chair of urology at Wayne and then afterwards at University of Michigan. And he was an incredible supporter. And Dr. Max Wisha, who was the center director there. So when I look at my whole career in terms of who helped me with things and mentored and guided and provided opportunity, I would say the majority were actually men. And the point here is this: this is not about being a man or being a woman. We are physicians, we are human beings, and we signed up, we've taken the oath to help people. And so, in that regard, I don't feel like I have had any challenges. And we're talking my fellowship started in 19, basically 86. So if you think about it, if then there were no issues, and as a foreign graduate and a woman with a funky name, Maha Hussein, which people didn't even know how to pronounce at the time, and I could go through the field and work. The point here is I would encourage, and I think I've told Sarah this, don't think of yourself, you are, XY or XX. We're humans, we're here to help humanity. So
I think that's a really great point. Dr. Fenton, did you have anything to add to that?
I don't think I have a lot to add. I think anybody, regardless of what the specific topic is, that you're a woman, that you're a man, what your race is, like everybody can think of specific stories where that played a role in how they felt they were treated or how patients thought of them or whatever the scenario is. Of course, I can look back and come up with a couple of examples, but the question really, I think, is best answered by zooming out and thinking about how your career as a whole was impacted. And I agree. I completely agree with Maha. Like, I don't think that being a woman has, on a daily or a monthly or whatever basis, impacted my opportunity. And I think people have really invested in me or listened to my ideas because of those ideas, and or not listened to them, or not because of my gender. And I sit at in our clinic, I sit at ASCO GU or Maine ASCO or SWOG meetings, and I look around the room, right? And there's a lot of women in the room, and that's exciting. And I do think that has changed, right? As Maha's career has during that time, and it's just an exciting time to practice.
See, my message is this, is work hard. You should get opportunities because you are worth it, and worth it at the brain and at the spirit level and all of that, and hardworking, not because of, your gender and what you are. And again, I think the key part for us, and it's been very gratifying for me, is that I've been working with, all kinds of people of different backgrounds, and we've really, I think, contributed significantly to moving the field forward and attracting more people, including women medical oncologists, into the field. My experience has been, and again, it's interesting. Remember, women are the sisters, the mothers, the daughters, and for some reason, again, from that part, you open up to your mom and tell her details, and so, or your sister in that regard. So what I found actually is it's amazing how when I'm interacting with men, and this is in an era where, again, there were no women medical oncologists, literally that many in the field, men opened up and were, willing to talk and share their feelings and how they're feeling and stuff like that. So there is that kind of effect also that helps in the GU field when practically 9 out of 10 patients I see are men. And
I
I'm sure
think,
Sarah is experiencing it now too.
So I think just because we're talking about mentorship, I know Dr. Hussein was your mentor, Dr. Fenton, as you kind of went through the last couple of years. So can you talk about maybe how that impacted your career trajectory, and any lessons that you learned and are helping you now as you're just starting out?
Yeah, sure. I mean, how has it not impacted my career trajectory? So I was a fellow at Northwestern, and trained as a physician scientist, and was really trying to decide, like, what is the distribution of work that I'm going to be doing? How much time am I going to be in clinic? How much time am I going to be doing basic science research, clinical research? Like, what is my career going to be? And before I even established as an official mentee of Maha's, she probably doesn't even remember this. I met with her like the first maybe 3 months of fellowship. I mean, I was like brand new. And I just was looking for overall advice. And it was actually quite similar to what she said before, which was just like work hard and figure out something that's worth your time in your mind, right? Like you're going to spend a lot of time on it. You're going to have a lot of passion and a lot of input and pick something that's important to you. And that was great advice because it took me a little while during fellowship to come to GU. I tried out other specialties first before I kind of realized the things I liked about GU and then really formally established that relationship. And from then, like, I mean, Maha, of course, has been great. The other physicians that work in our group, David Vander Wiel, Neeraj Shenoy, like, we have a really great group of people that really lift each other up, and that's a really important thing. I think especially at this phase of my career, you can get dejected. It's important to be lifted up. You can do things that you think are important for your career that aren't important to you personally. Do you know, does that make sense? Like you can take a project or you can take something that an industry partner is offering you just because you think it's an opportunity. You need to stick with things that are important to you and are worth your time and you think are going to help people. And I think that is like the best piece of advice that Maha's given me as I've been moving through and thinking about, what projects am I going to start and where am I going to really work hard.
No, that's great piece of advice. Dr. Hussein, I know you talked a little bit about your mentors before, but how did those relationships kind of impact your career trajectory?
I think it was wonderful in that they guided me, they provided me support. When I had ideas, I went to them, and a good chunk of my ideas end up being translated and helped. And so I think, like anything else, you have to work hard. Nothing comes free in this world, and you have to be passionate about what you're doing. And frankly, I've mentored so many people over the years, including men who chose to go into GU oncology. So I do think, again, I would encourage all of us to think about what is the mission and what is it that we're trying to do. And ultimately, my hope is that we're going to cure cancer, hopefully. But that's not going to happen emotionally. It's going to have to happen through objective work and science and activity. And we need everybody to work together.
Great. And then throughout our conversation, you have both touched on pieces of advice you've held close to you throughout your career. To a woman that's just starting out in the GU field, do you have anything specific that you would say to her?
I mean, I don't know that this is GU specific, but one thing as a woman entering the field of medicine or entering any profession where you have to put a lot of work into it, I remember really struggling with like, well, what about the family part of it, right? Like, when am I gonna have? I wanted children. I knew that was something that was important to me. When is that gonna figure in? How am I gonna do that? And I remember talking to one of my residency mentors who was like, look, I mean, there are seasons to your career, right? Like, if you end up having kids and that becomes a period of time where you're not putting, hours and hours and weekends and all this time into work because you have a newborn, that's okay. You have to think a little bit broader. You need to recognize that even if at this moment you feel like you're not 1000% at work, it's going to be that way in the future. And it's seasons, and that shifts from day to day, it shifts from week to week, and you just need to think about what's important to you and really try to attain all those things. And that just really shifted my way of thinking about starting a family, which was an important thing to me. And now I have two little kids, and they're the best. And Maha has to hear about them all the time.
I know, and you should make two more.
I think that's really great. Kind of something we've been hearing across the board as we've been speaking with different women.
That's
Dr.
awesome.
Hussein, do you have any advice that you'd like to give?
Yeah, I think family is very important. And I do think that as women, it's very critical to balance the personal life and the professional life. And being a mother doesn't give you a credit in your career, technically. That's a reality. And so I would say, and I know Sarah heard me say this before, I would say sleep is overrated. Work hard. And figure out how to balance things. And again, as a person who came in from Iraq, I'm from Baghdad, born and raised there, did my medical school there. We came in as immigrants and as interns when we started our career there. Literally, we made $5. Well, maybe not exactly $5, but basically, I think my salary first year was 17,000. And I got my son actually. I was pregnant the whole year. We were on call every third night. And I could do it. And so the point here is this, is you have to be setting yourself up and deciding your priorities, and you can parallel track your career and your personal life. And I would say motherhood is wonderful. And it's a wonderful opportunity to be a mother, but at the same time, it was a wonderful opportunity to be a physician and moving the field and moving in the field there. And work hard, but don't forget that your personal life is very important because a happy personal life also reflects on your work life.
That's great. Just as we're coming up on time here, did either of you have anything else that you wanted to add today, as we conclude our discussion?
Well, maybe I can say one thing. Work hard, and I always tell everybody I say, girls will save the world, so we need to work hard even more. But I would love for us, again, this is a field that needs all different people from different backgrounds there because the ultimate goal is to conquer cancer and impact our patients' lives at multiple levels, from a quality of life to quantity of life to curing them and preventing cancer from coming back. And as a team, I think we are going to be able to do that, working together for sure.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.